In the morning, Lorin was as charming as only he can be. He apologized handsomely for the previous evening. "I just wanted to be alone, Ben. I'm sorry. I get like that sometimes." "Yes, I know, Lo. I'm the same." In 10 minutes, we'd agreed that although the circumstantial evidence of a Phoenician occupation of the city was most encouraging, it was not conclusive. We would not make any public announcement yet, but in the meantime, Lorin gave me complete carte blanche to proceed with a full-scale excavation and investigation. He flew out with the dawn, and I knew he would be in London for breakfast the following morning. The weeks that followed Lorin's departure were dissatisfying for me. Although the work on the ruins went forward steadily, and my assistants never faltered in their enthusiasm and industry, yet the results were uniformly disappointing. There were other finds, many of them, but they were repetitive. Pottery, beads, even the occasional gold fragment or ornament no longer thrilled me as it had before. There was nothing that added a scrap of knowledge to the store we had accumulated already. I roved the site restlessly, anxiously hovering over a new trench or exposed level, praying that the next spadeful of earth turned would expose an inscribed pallet or the headstone to a burial vault. Somewhere here was the key to the ancient mystery, but it was well hidden. Apart from the lack of progress on the excavation, my relationship with Sally had deteriorated in some subtle fashion, which I was at a loss to explain. Naturally, there had been no opportunity for any physical intimacy since the arrival of the others at the City of the Moon. Sally was adamant in her determination not to allow our affair to become common knowledge. My amateurish maneuverings to get her alone were deftly countered. The nearest I came to success was when I visited her at the cavern during the day, and even here she had her assistant with her, and often Heather Wilcox as well. She seemed withdrawn, taciturn, even surly. She worked over her easel with a fierce concentration during the day, and she usually slipped away to her hut immediately after dinner. Once I followed her, knocking softly on the door of her hut, and then hesitantly pushing the door open when there was no reply. She wasn't there. I waited in the shadows, feeling like a peeping Tom. And it was after midnight before she returned, slipping out of the silent grove like a ghost and going directly to her room, where Leslie had long ago switched out the light. It was distressing for me to see my laughing Sally so withdrawn, and finally I visited her at the cavern. "I want to talk to you, Sal." "What about?" She looked at me with mild surprise, as though it were the first time in days that she'd noticed me. I sent the young African assistant away and prevailed on Sally to join me on the rocks beside the Emerald Pool, hoping that its beauty and associations would soften her mood. "Is something wrong, Sal?" "Good Lord, should there be?" It was an awkward, unsatisfying conversation. Sally seemed to feel I was prying into affairs that did not concern me. I felt my anger rising, and I wanted to shout at her, "I'm your lover, damn you, and everything you do concerns me." But good sense prevailed, for I am sure presumption of that magnitude from me would have severed the last tenuous threads of our relationship. Instead, I took her hand, and hating myself for the blush that burnt my cheeks, I told her softly, "I love you, Sally. Just remember that. If there's ever anything I can do..." I think it was probably the best thing I could have said, for immediately her hand tightened on mine, and her face softened. Her eyes went slightly misty. "Ben, you're a sweet, dear person. Don't take any notice of me for a while. I've just got the blues. There's nothing anybody can do about it. They'll go on their own, if you don't fuss." For a moment, she was my old girl again, a smile quivering precariously on the corners of her mouth and in those great green eyes. "Well, let me know when it's over, won't you?" I stood up. "Yes, I will, Doctor. You'll be the first to know." The following week, I flew back to Johannesburg. There was the annual general meeting of the trustees of the Institute, which I couldn't avoid, and I was committed to a series of lectures for the Faculty of Archaeology at the University of Witwatersrand. I was scheduled to be away from the site for 11 days. I left it all in Peter Wilcox's safe hands after extracting from him a promise that he would cable me immediately if any new development broke. The three girls fussed around me, packing my case, making a picnic lunch for me to eat on the plane, and lining up to kiss me goodbye at the airstrip. I must admit that I rather enjoyed all the attention. I've often found that living too close to any problem narrows one's view of the whole. 3 hours after leaving the City of the Moon, I made a minor breakthrough. If there had been walls and towers standing on the ruined foundations, then the rock must have been brought from nearby. The obvious place was from the cliffs themselves. Somewhere in those cliffs, close to the city, there was a quarry. I would find it, and from its extent, I would calculate the actual size of the city. For the first time in weeks, I felt good, and the days that followed were gratifying and solidly enjoyable. The meeting of the trustees was the type of festive affair which can be expected when funds are unlimited and prospects are favourable. From the chair, Lurin was a most complimentary chairman when he renewed my contract as director of the Institute for a further 12 months. To celebrate the 30% rise in my remuneration, he invited me to a dinner at his home, where 40 people sat down at the yellow wood table in the huge dining room, and I was the guest of honour. Hilary Stuyvesant, in a gown of yellow brocade silk and wearing the fabled Stuyvesant diamonds, gave me her almost undivided attention during the meal. I have a weakness for beautiful things, particularly if they are women. There were 20 of them there that night, and in the drawing room afterwards I held court like royalty. The wine had loosened my tongue and washed away my confounded shyness. No matter that Hilary and Lurin had probably primed the other guests to make a fuss of me, for when at 2 o'clock in the morning I went down to the Mercedes with Hilary and Lurin escorting me, I swaggered along 7 feet tall. This newfound confidence carried me through the series of 4 lectures at the University of the Witwatersrand, the first of which was attended by 25 students and faculty members, the latter outnumbering the former 2 to 1. The word got out, however, and my final venue was changed to one of the main lecture theatres to handle the audience of 600 that turned up. I was an unqualified success. I was prevailed upon to return at an early date, and there was an unsubtle hint from the vice-chancellor of the university that the archaeology chair would fall vacant the following year. For the last 3 days of my visit, I spent every minute at the Institute. With relief, I found that not much had suffered in my absence, and my multitudinous staff had kept things running smoothly. The Bushman exhibition in the Kalahari Room was completed and open to the public. It was magnificently executed, and the central figure of the main group reminded me sharply of my little friend Chai. The model was depicted in the act of painting on the stone wall of a cave abode. With his stoppered buckhorn paint pots and reed pipes and brushes, I imagined that this was how the artist who had painted My White King had worked. It gave me an odd sensation, as though 2 millennia had rolled away, as though I could send my mind back along the years. I spoke of it to Timothy McGeeber.
"Yes, Mahani, I have told you before that you and I are marked. We have the sign of the spirits on us, and we have the sight."
I smiled and shook my head. "I don't know about you, Timothy, but I've never been able to pick a winner."
"I am serious, Doctor," Timothy rebuked me. "You have the gift. It is merely that you have never been taught to develop it."
I would accept hypnotism, but talk of clairvoyance, necromancy, mantology, and the like leaves me feeling embarrassed. To divert the conversation from me and my gifts, I asked, "You have told me before that you also are marked by the spirits." Timothy looked at me steadily from out of those disturbing black eyes. At first I thought I'd insulted him by my thinly disguised question, but suddenly he nodded that cannonball head. He stood up, closed and locked the door of his office before returning to his seat.
quickly his stripped shoe and sock from his right foot and showed it to me. The deformity was shocking, although I'd seen photographs of it before. It was a fairly common occurrence among the Batonga tribe of the Zambezi Valley. There had been a paper on it published in the British Medical Journal during 1969. The condition was known as ostrich-footed and consisted of a massive division between the metatarsus of the big toe and the second toe. The effect was to make the foot resemble the claw of an ostrich or a predatory bird. Timothy was obviously very sensitive about this deformity and almost immediately replaced his sock and shoe. I realized later that he had shown it to me in a deliberate attempt to enlist my sympathy, to create a bond between us. "Both feet?" I asked, and he nodded. "There are many people in the Zambezi Valley with feet like that," I told him. "My mother was a Batonga woman," he answered. "It was this mark that qualified me for training in the mysteries." "Does it hinder you at all?" I asked. "No," he answered brusquely, and then went on almost defiantly in Batonga. "We men of the cloven feet outrun the fleetest antelope." It was a beneficial mutation, then, and I would have enjoyed discussing it further, but I was warned by Timothy's expression. I realized the effort it had taken him to show me. "Will you have some tea, Doctor?" He reverted to English, closing the subject. When one of his young African assistants had poured cups of strong black tea for us, Timothy asked, "Please tell me how the work at the City of the Moon is progressing, Doctor." We chatted for another half hour, and then I left him. "You must excuse me now, Timothy. I'm flying back tomorrow morning early, and there's still much to do." I was awakened by a soft but insistent knocking on the door of my suite in the Institute. I switched on the bedside light and saw that the time was 3 o'clock in the morning. "Who is there?" I called, and the knocking stopped. I slipped out of bed, shrugged into a dressing gown and slippers, and started for the front door, when I realized the risk I was taking. I went back to my bedroom and took the big, ugly automatic .45 from the drawer. Feeling a little melodramatic, I pumped around into the chamber and went back to the front door. "Who is it?" I repeated.
"It's me. It's me, Doctor. Timothy."
I hesitated a moment longer. Anybody could call themselves Timothy. "Are you alone?" I asked in Kalahari Bushman.
"I am alone, Sunbird,"
he answered in the same language, and I slipped the pistol into my pocket and opened the door. Timothy was dressed in dark blue slacks and a white shirt, with a wind cheater thrown over his shoulders, and I noticed immediately that there were spots of fresh blood on the shirt, and that there was a rather grubby cloth wrapped round his left forearm. He was clearly much agitated, his eyes wide and staring in the light, and his movements jerky and nervous.
"Good God, Timothy, are you all right?" "I've had a terrible night, Doctor. I had to see you right away."
"What have you done to your arm?"
"I cut it on the windowpane of my front door. I fell in the dark," he explained.
"Well, you'd better let me have a look at it." And I went towards him.
No, Doctor, it's only a scratch. What I have come to tell you is more important."
"Well, sit down at least," I told him. "Can I get you a drink?"
"A drink, thank you, Mahani. As you can see, I am upset and nervous, and that is how I came to injure my arm."
I poured both of us whiskey, and he took his glass in his right hand and continued moving nervously around my sitting room while I sat in one of the big leather armchairs. "What is it, Timothy?" I prompted him.
"It is difficult to begin, Mahani, for you are not a believer. But I must convince you."
He broke off and drank whiskey before turning to face me. Yesterday evening, we spoke at length about the City of the Moon. You told me how there are mysteries there that still baffle you. Yes, and I nodded encouragement. The burial grounds of the ancients, Timothy went on. You cannot find them. Yes, that's true, Timothy. Since then, I have thought heavily on this matter. He changed into Venda, a language better suited for the discussion of the occult. I went back in my memory over all the legends of our people. I imagined vividly how he must have thrown himself into hypnotic trance to search. And there was something else there, like a shadow beyond the firelight, a dark memory that eluded me. He shook his head and turned away, pacing restlessly, sipping at his drink, muttering softly to himself as though he still searched in the dark archives of his mind. It was no use, Doctor. I knew it was there, but I could not grasp it. I despaired of it, and at last I slept. But it was a sleep greatly troubled by the dream demons, until at last, and he hesitated, until at last my grandfather came to me. I stirred uneasily in my chair. Timothy's grandfather had lain 25 years in a murderer's grave. All right, Doctor. Timothy saw my small movement of disbelief and changed smoothly to English. I know you do not believe such things can happen. Let me explain it in terms you can accept. My imagination, heated by my search for a long-forgotten fragment of knowledge, threw up a dream image of my grandfather, the one from whom that knowledge was learnt in the first place. I smiled to cover my spooky feelings. At this time of night, with this half-demented black man talking of dark things, I felt myself falling under his spell. Go on, Timothy. I tried to say it lightly, but my voice croaked a little. My grandfather came to me, and he touched my shoulder, and he said, "Go with the Blessed One to the Hills of Blood, and there I will make the mysteries known to you and open up the secret places." I felt my skin prickle. Timothy had said, "The Hills of Blood," and nobody had told him that name. The Hills of Blood, I repeated. "That is the name he used," Timothy agreed. "I can only believe he meant your City of the Moon." I was silent. Reasonable man at war with primitive superstitious man within me. "You want to come with me tomorrow, Timothy?" I asked. "I will go with you," Timothy agreed. "And perhaps I will be able to show you something for which you search. And then again, I may not be able to." Well, there was certainly nothing to lose. Timothy was obviously sincere. He was still tense and nervously aware. "I have already invited you to join me, Timothy, and I was very disappointed when you refused. Of course you may come with me. We can certainly see if the sight of the ruins stirs something in your memory."
"Thank you, Doctor. What time will you leave?"
I glanced at my watch. "Good Lord, it's 4 o'clock already. We'll leave at 6.
Then I must hurry home and pack."
Timothy replaced his glass on my cabinet, and then he turned to me.
"There is a small snag, Doctor. My travel papers have expired, and we will have to cross an international border into Botswana."
"Oh, damn it," I muttered, deeply disappointed.
You'll have to get them renewed and come up with me on the next trip.
As you wish, Doctor, he agreed readily. Of course, it will take 2 or 3 weeks, and by then the whole thing might have faded from my memory.
Yes, yes, I nodded. But I felt a prick of temptation. I am usually a law-abiding person, but now, as I thought about it, I saw that no harm could come from what I intended. The chance that Timothy might lead me to the burial grounds of the ancients was worth any risk.
Would you like to take a chance, Timothy, I asked.
Formalities concerned with the coming and going of Stuyvesant aircraft had been reduced to a minimum. There were daily arrivals and departures, and a phone call to the airport authorities was all that was necessary before departure. The Stuyvesant name carried such weight that there was never a headcount on arrival or departure. At the City of the Moon, Loren had arranged special status with the Botswana government, and we were virtually free from bothersome red tape. I could have Timothy in and out within 3 days with nobody the wiser, and no damage done. Roger Van Deventer would accept my word that Loren had sanctioned the flat. I could see no problems.
Very well, Doctor, if you think it's safe.
Timothy agreed to my proposal. Well, be at Stuyvesant Hangar before 6. I sat down to scribble a note. If you're questioned at the airport gate, which I doubt, show them this. It's a note authorizing you to deliver goods to the Stuyvesant Hangar. Park your car behind the flight office and wait for me in the office. Quickly, we made our arrangements, and when I stood at the window of my bedroom and watched Timothy's old blue Chevy pull out of the Institute car park, I felt a mixture of elation and apprehension. Idly, I wondered what the penalty was for aiding illegal exit and entry, and then dismissed the thought and went to make myself some coffee.